Good morning. Welcome to the March 6th, 2017 meeting of the House Committee on Economic Development and Trade. Today we are going to be covering a number of topics that are relevant to the beverage sector, which, as we've discussed in high overview, is a really important and growing and prospering sector in Oregon's economy that we would love to expand Oregon's market share of in the traded sector. And we are going to be hearing some background from experts in the field, and we are going to be looking at four bills, the goal of which is to ease administrative burden for producers so that they can operate more efficiently and expand market share. We'll begin this morning by inviting Renee Niedermeyer and Jesse Sweet of OLCC to come forward. Ms. Niedermeyer is the Government Affairs and Communications Director of OLCC and has had a lot of different roles in the Capitol, which make her a tremendous resource. And Jesse Sweet is a Senior Policy Advisor and trained attorney with the OLCC. Welcome. Thanks for being here today.
Thank you.
Good morning. For the record, my name is Renee Niedermeyer. I'm the Director of Government Affairs and Communications for the OLCC. What we're going to be doing today is just giving a brief overview of the size and scope of Oregon's alcohol industry, and then also a brief overview of the four bills that are before you today. But before I get started, I want to just tell you an experience that I had. When about 3 years ago, when I first came to the OLCC, a week later, I attended a small distillers event. There were about 20 distillers. And I spent about 2 hours. I had 2 hours. I went and talked to every one of them. And what came out of that is their stories were very, very similar. They were leasing land, buying land. They were buying equipment. They were employing people. They were buying services such as marketing and labels. And it really struck me because much of their work was in rural Oregon. And having moved from Josephine County, I realized how important those jobs are all over the state, but to rural Oregon as well. I'll get it here. And that same story is true as I talked to vintners and brewers, and that investment in growing the economy is all over the state. We have about 1,100 wineries in Oregon. We have 330 brew pubs and breweries. We have 96 distillers, and many of them have secondary locations. Restaurants and bars, the mixology culture is very strong in Oregon. We have 7,400 of those, 8,900 special event licenses throughout Oregon. I'll just talk briefly a little bit about that later. We have 1,400 distillers, 4,700 grocery and convenience stores, 268 liquor stores, and 157 alcohol permittees, 157,000 alcohol permittees throughout Oregon. Huge impact on employment, agriculture, construction, transportation, equipment, services, supplies, and of course, taxes. The alcohol industry in Oregon is the third largest revenue generator for the state of Oregon. It grosses $1.2 billion throughout the biennium. Most of that's from distilled spirit sales. About 49% of that revenue is given to paid back to manufacturers for their costs. 8.8% is to liquor store commissions, and 5% is OLCC's operations. With a projected alcohol revenue distribution of $467 million during this during the biennium, that's distributed to cities, counties, for health services, and general fund, all creating jobs and supporting communities. in Oregon, and that that distribution is sent out monthly. I thought it might be helpful to show a map of where some of these are, these industries are located. And this is Oregon's wine industry. Creates 13,500 jobs that was, came from the Oregon Craft Brewing Beverage Council. The, for according to Full Glass Research, Oregon wine industry is worth $3.35 billion to Oregon's economy. And you can see there's some definite concentrations in the I-5 corridor, but there are also many wineries on the coast and the top of Oregon, and they continue to grow. And as you can see from this graph, they're growing about 8% a year. Oregon breweries have a similar footprint, although they're a little more dispersed throughout Oregon. And as you can see, more than 18% of all the beer consumed in Oregon is from an Oregon brewer. It has a $2.83 billion impact on Oregon's economy, according to the Beer Institute data. 6,500 jobs, and according to the Oregon Brewers Council, about half of Oregon's breweries are in rural areas. And as you can see, they're growing even faster at 12%. There are 96 licensed distillers in Oregon, 38 secondary locations, about 600 distilled products, and they also contribute to Oregon's tourism and thriving mixology culture. Growing at 12% per year.
That's good.
Yes, please.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Can you just explain the different icons on this distillery map? It looks like there's some martini glasses and there's some other.
Some of them, and I apologize for that. They're some of them are the martini glasses, I believe, are the secondary locations where they're doing tastings.
Okay.
Great. There are 270 retail outlets for distilled liquor throughout Oregon. They serve over 7,400 bars and restaurants across Oregon. More than 1,000 people are employed in our distillery outlets, in as our liquor stores, and over 600 products are available. Oregon products are available in those stores. I thought I'd put this slide here to talk about tourism a little bit and jobs. We at OLCC, we issue 8,900, close to 9,000 temporary sales licenses for special events each year. These are festivals, brewfests, farmers markets, fundraisers. These are the events that often, you know, Taste of Ashland or Taste of Bite of Portland. These are ones that have generate excitement and a sense of community and contributes to tourism. We have 1,500 wineries, breweries, and distilleries that enhances Oregon's reputation. We have 7,400 bars and restaurants and have created a robust mixology culture in Oregon. And again, 157,000 alcohol service permits. According to the Oregon Tourism, the Oregon Travel Impacts Board, Oregon Tourism generated $10.8 billion in 2015. And and the alcohol industry has contributed to that number. At OLCR, we recognize that our rules and regulations can have a significant impact on these small businesses and community livability. So we have our mission is to support these businesses while we're supporting public safety and community livability through the education of liquor laws. We realize that Oregon's beverage industry creates thousands of jobs throughout Oregon, literally from the ground up. They're from agriculture to being served in the restaurants and special events where they're served. So we're getting to the let me just say this, that we do our rules and regulations, and we bring in many of the industry folks. We think it's really important to listen to them and to see if there are rules or regulations that are getting in the way or hindering their progress in some ways. And if it makes sense to adjust our rules to help them grow, we do that. And we've done that on growlers and various other different things throughout the year. So what we're going to do right now is just briefly go through the four bills, and then we'll available for questions.
Thank you. For the record, I'm Jesse Sweet with the OLCC, and I will be brief in my summary here because OLCC staff will be coming back up as these bills are called today. The first bill on the slide is House Bill 2160, and that addresses the Brewery Public House, which is how the majority of Oregon brewers are licensed. Essentially, 2160 intends to allow brew pubs in Oregon who have expanded beyond a first and second location greater flexibility in their licensing at additional locations. Also before you today, you will see HB 2089, which allows our retail liquor agents to purchase vermouth from a wholesaler and sell that vermouth to retail customers. Currently, we stock in our warehouse about 10 vermouths, which we ship to agents, and this again allows additional flexibility for agents that want to stock a larger range of products without acquiring additional licensure. HB 2159 deals with cider. This is fairly simple. Cider is defined as either a cider or a wine by statute according to the alcohol content, and it is taxed differently according to that definition. Recently, federal government adjusted their definition of cider, so this brings Oregon in step with the federal government in terms of the legal definition of cider and should allow our cider makers ease of filing so that they're dealing with consistent definitions throughout. And finally, we have HB 2150, which is the electronic privilege tax filing system. Requires OLCC to develop the system for online filing of beer and wine taxes. Those are taxes that are paid by wholesalers and importers.
And I just wanted to follow up on that one. There are 40, as I mentioned before, there are 4,700 breweries, wineries, brew pubs, warehouses, and wholesalers, and out-of-state manufacturers that pay beer and wine taxes. They report monthly. Currently, it's a manual paper process. They send their paper forms in, and we manually take that information and put it into spreadsheets, and so that we can reconcile them and see that the taxes are paid appropriately. There are about 28,000 forms a year, about 140,000 pieces of paper. And with this bill, the manual process could be eliminated.
That's great. Do we have any questions for this panel? Then I would like to make a comment, a twofold comment. I want to thank Representative Gomberg, under whose leadership, together with his co-chair, Greg Smith, Representative Smith, the House Special Committee on Small Business Growth developed these bills and brought them forward as part of what we see and saw at the time as an effort to streamline some of the administrative hurdles that our small businesses have to jump through, or that our beverage, alcohol-related businesses have to jump through as they go from you know, rural agriculture to value-added processing and distilling to ultimate traded sector sales. And our hope at the time and continues to be that by implementing these common sense refinements, we can make the path smoother and more productive for our small businesses. We're delighted to have a couple of business owners here today who are going to follow up. But I want to flag for folks that of the four bills here, two are not quite ready to move. And so we're going to, after we have our initial presentations, we're going to call forward first the two bills that are ready to move today, and then afterwards we're going to have the two bills for which some final refinements are still needed so that we can prepare to move those forward eventually. And with that, no questions. Thank you so much for your work. This team, I'll just also say as you're sitting down, Rep. Helm and I have had the good fortune of working with these good people on the Joint Marijuana Regulation Committee, and I could not be more pleased with their customer service orientation and desire to make adjustments to support the sector in that space, and it seems to me like they're doing that same kind of good work in this arena, so we're lucky to have them. All right, and we are also lucky to have Dan Engler, president of the Oregon Brewers Guild, and Ted Pappas, president of the Oregon Distillers Guild. I would love to invite you forward now so that you can share with us your thoughts on how the beverage sector is evolving from your standpoint and steps that we can take as the Economic Development and Trade Committee to support your continued success and growth. Thanks for being here today, especially with the snow.
Yeah, thank you.
Didn't begin in any order.
You got
probably the Brewers Guild would be a good choice.
All right. I'm happy to be here today. Dan Engler. I'm a co-owner and brewmaster of Occidental Brewing Company in Portland, and I'm also the current president of the Oregon Brewers Guild. A few things about me and my brewery quickly. Occidental was I started with my nephew in 2011. We brewed our first batch of beer Memorial Day weekend that year. We're a small family-owned business. And that first year, just the last 6 months of 2011, we produced 180 barrels of beer. And this last year, 2016, we produced almost 2,700 barrels. So we've had steady and sustained growth. We'll probably break 3,000 barrels in 2017. In the beginning, it was just the two of us doing everything from the brewing to sales, distribution, and working in our tap room. And now we're up to 10 employees. We have a couple of full-time employees in the brewery, a salesperson, a full-time retail and marketing manager, and about six people full and part-time in our retail operations, having opened a new restaurant across the parking lot from the brewery this year. And so we've been doing some slow and steady expansion. I expect it will continue on that way, and I think that's a pretty common thread in the Oregon brewing industry. I like to kind of characterize the craft beer industry as kind of a unicorn because it's a thriving American manufacturing industry, which is, becoming increasingly rare these days. And there are some pretty impressive numbers that come out of the craft beer industry in Oregon. There are 261 breweries in 73 cities that produced 1.7 million barrels of beer in 2015. We don't have the 2016 numbers up yet, but that's a total estimated economic impact of about $1.8 billion, which is not insignificant. Slides here.
Actually, just click.
That's estimated to give us like a total direct and indirect number of jobs in the area of about 31,000, and that includes all of the industries that brewing touches on, from agriculture to tradespeople, suppliers, equipment manufacturers, folks in distribution, sales, and then the retail end of things. We have the we're second per capita in both economic impact and number of breweries in the state. And an interesting fact that I like to point out is that between, I think it was January of 2008 and June of 2016, Oregon added 7,100 jobs in the brewing industry, which was actually more than the software industry in the state. So definitely some explosive growth there. You'll see that we've had about $167 million in just direct payroll in the brewing industry. And there are four counties where the total private employment in those counties was more than 1.5% breweries. It's interesting to note that Hood River County, which is almost at 2%, there's five breweries in Hood River County, which is one brewery for every little over 1,400 residents. So it's definitely significant in the state. One thing that we like to point out is that it's not just slide here to that effect. It's not just the metro areas that have all the funds. So there's significant impact in rural areas as well. So you'll see that of the 73 cities in Oregon that have breweries, 54 of them are in rural areas, and that totals 106 companies. And there's only five counties in the state at this point that don't have a brewery, but rural jobs, rural brewing jobs, full-time and part-time are over almost 2,400 jobs, and a good chunk of the barrelage produced in Oregon breweries was in rural areas. So it does touch on a broad swath of the state, not just the metro areas. Although I'm sure that you've seen some stats about how Portland is currently the number one city in the world for breweries, not just per capita, but total breweries in the city of Portland, at 70 right now. And let's see, another stat, jumping around a little bit, but another stat that I do like to point out is that 63% of draft beer consumed in Oregon was brewed in Oregon. And I think that points to one of the many important factors that have made Oregon the pioneer in the craft brewing industry for over 30 years, and that is that folks in Oregon tend to support local products more so than a lot of markets. And that, along with access to raw materials, great water, and a very favorable legal framework, is what's put Oregon on the map in terms of being the pioneer for a long time of the craft industry. Another interesting thing about craft beer as a manufacturing industry is that not only are we manufacturers in the beverage industry, but it's an industry that drives a lot of tourism. And we saw a little bit of that in the OLCC presentation. But taking some snapshots from both Bend and Portland here, you can see that the number three activity, tourism activity in Bend, was visiting a brewery, and 53% of folks, tourists in Bend, plan to visit a brewery or have a craft brewing experience, and 81% had that same response in Portland, with over a third of people saying that was the reason they were visiting the Portland area was for craft beer. So that's a really unique situation, and again shows how much the craft brewing industry ties into other industries in Oregon, be it tourism or agriculture, and other manufacturers that support the craft industry. In terms of agriculture, we'll see the involvement of our significant hop-growing industry in Oregon, fruit. We have two of the major national yeast producers for beer and also other fermentation industries are located in Oregon. And then, of course, you have all the various tradespeople that support brewing facilities and then the distribution chains as well. Here we've got some numbers showing growth in brewery jobs and total beer production in Oregon. You can see it's steadily climbing. Oregon exports beer to at least four continents. My brewery exports to, or we send beer out to about four states currently and Canada. And so while we do consume a lot of our product here in Oregon, we also do some significant exporting. You can jump back to the slide with those numbers here. So I guess in summation, I would just say that you know, we're in a very unique spot here in Oregon, given the kind of confluence of factors that have made it a great place to make craft beer. The economic impact on the state can't be overstated, and you know, on behalf of the Brewers Guild, it's a trajectory that we want to see continue. I think that we've just been in a really good spot, being able to work together with our industries, the involved industries, the regulators, and the legislature, to keep this industry moving forward and supporting the high number of Oregonians that it does. Thanks for your time.
Mr. Pappas.
All right. So, no slides. So now you just have to pay attention to me. So sorry about that. But let's talk about the industry a little bit, and just to kind of put it out there.
And if you could start by introducing yourself for the record.
Oh, thank you. My name is Ted Pappas. I'm the owner of Big Bottom Distilling in Hillsboro, Oregon. I'm also the president and have been for about the last 3 years of the Oregon Distillers Guild. Just kind of a side note, this is probably the last time you'll see me. My term is up at the end of the month, so you will still be in capable hands, but I'm glad I actually got to come here today, and so thank you for arranging that so I can kind of give you a state of what's going on and what we're looking for. What's a DSP? A DSP is a distilled spirits plant, and that's how we measure everything when we take a look and want to compare apples to apples from Oregon and other states. It will differ a little bit from the OLCC's numbers. They actually monitor distillery licenses, which is different. You can have a distillery license but not have a DSP. So I just wanted to get that out so you don't think that I'm giving you different numbers than the OLCC. They actually are correct, just a different unit of measuring it. Currently right now, Oregon is sitting at about 88 DSPs in the state. You can have a DSP and be a winery, but from looking at most of the licenses, we have over 80 actual spirit-producing, able-to-drink DSPs in the state, so that's a pretty good ratio. When you look at California that has 292 DSPs, there's a whole bunch of wineries in there. So you do kind of get a little, you have to understand the numbers a little bit, but what they do is they help establish a trend in growth, and that's one of the things that I'm gonna really look at so we can do some comparison with that. We currently, like I said, have a little bit over 90 spirit-producing DSPs in the state, which is great. There's been growth really recently, and Oregon Distillers Guild has tried to position ourselves to make sure that we can capture all those new members. Which is a good thing. We have over half the distilleries involved in the Distillers Guild right now. We're looking to continue that membership drive so we actually present a common voice. We have been primary for the common voice for quite some time now, and we'll continue to do that. And the more members we get, the more power comes to it. I might not be around for the discussion on HB 2089, but I want to say it's a great bill. The story behind that one is I was bending Representative Leininger's ear for about 55 minutes on taxation, And the last 5 minutes of our conversation, I just started just a shots on goal. I was throwing everything out there to her. And one of the things that slipped out was, God, wouldn't it be great to get a bottle of vermouth when you're on a distillery? She paid attention. And so I really do appreciate paying attention and getting that on there because it's a big deal. It's an evolutionary change that we're looking at. And that's what we've been doing a lot over the last 5 years or so is evolutionary changes. And that's what I want to talk to you. I want to read you something that happened. This actually happened in New York in 2014. And this is a quote from then governor, or could be, I'm not sure if it's current governor, but Governor Cuomo. New York produces some of the best wine, beer, spirits, and cider in the world, an industry which not only creates jobs but supports farmers and brings tourism dollars across every corner of the state. This new law builds upon the administration's ongoing effort to promote this industry by cutting red tape, reducing burdensome regulations, and removing artificial barriers that stifle growth. New York is truly open for business, and I thank all my partners in the legislature for their hard work in making this a success for all our craft beverage businesses. Just replace New York with Oregon, and that's exactly what we're trying to do. But what did New York do? So this was in 2014, November 2014, when this was signed. And part of the things that actually got approved at that time was, and this, by the way, was for beer, wine, spirits, and cider. So they really took a look at just like this. They allow producers to sell not only by the bottle, but by the glass. That's something distilleries cannot do today because of constitutional food requirements. They had the same similar type of thing, but they lowered the food requirement that must be met by manufacturers when offering tastings and consumption on premise. They recognized that and took the bold step to remove it, which is a lot of things that we're doing here. Some of the other things were very specific to them, to their state, because we already have it in place. But speaking of the cocktail part, in Colorado, I've talked to several distilleries there. We go to national conventions, and believe it or not, we actually work, though we do party a good amount. One of the reasons that they are a set-up business in Colorado is because they can sell cocktails in their tasting room. And they put their distillery in a place that's going to get foot traffic in order to do that. So they're putting them in more visible locations. You need a Ouija board and a ditch witch to kind of find my place sometimes because I was looking for cheap rent. I need a lot of square feet. It's not something that I looked at the time when I opened up, being able to be in that foot traffic area. But it's part of their business plan when they go about the ability to do this. That's huge. That's revolutionary thinking, not evolutionary in that case. It's a big difference with that one. Now, when you talk about what we can do as a distillery outlet, 6 years ago, we were the belle of the ball. We had tasting rooms. We could sell bottles and such and what have you, and it was a really good place. A couple years later, we refined that even more, introduced the bottle bill, actually able to sell even in more places on an SED type thing. Past session, two sessions ago, I actually got another change to that where we now could actually use other people's spirits and cocktails when we did have a permission to do that, and we could have an SED at our own location. All those evolutionary steps that we've tried to do and continue to do. The vermouth bill is one of those evolutionary steps as we continue to grow, but we needed your help to do that. We work really well with the OLCC, but we've kind of gotten to the point where we need to look to you guys to really help us out. And one of the places that is our distillery outlet. So when you go into a retail liquor store, the state floors all the product that's there. We all know that. It's no secret. It's what happens. When you walk into my tasting room, I floor it. I pay for that product on the shelf until it's purchased. I pay for the federal excise tax. I pay for the labor that went in to make it. I'm flooring it. But yet I'm classified the exact same way as a non-exclusive retailer who probably has revenue of $5 million a year. I don't even have close to that. We have the same fiscal cliff as they do, which is if we sell more than $10,000 in a month, then our new commission goes from 22% to 8%. It's a different setup. We talked to the OLCC about this, but they're doing the right thing. They present a budget. There's a line item for commission. They have to balance it out, and they have to determine a method to do that. It makes total sense. But we need revolutionary here. That's what we're looking at to be able to do this. States like Utah, that very progressive state, has even figured out how to do a different markup for small distilleries versus large. Utah. Sorry, I almost sounded like Trump with Sweden. Anyway, we're not going to get on that path. But there's one thing I do want to call out to you. talk about revolutionary, there's one thing I left out of the bill from New York that was in 2014. They basically gave the industry $3 million in the form of grants that were to be used on marketing, promotion, and tourism. Their state got behind their industry so much where not only did they relieve some of the burdensome activities that were going on with the red tape, they promoted them and gave them money. That's revolutionary. So these things I've outlined have been they're pretty significant, but where's the proof on that one? Let's go back to New York and look at my handy-dandy stat sheet. And I can tell you when I started the business in 2010, New York wasn't even in the top 10 as far as DSPs go. They were down in the single digits. They were a blip. And then, of course, my computer crashed, and so I have nothing before July of 2014. But in July of 2014, New York had 92 DSPs. Oregon had 63. Okay, July 14. Bill was signed in November of 14. March 15, New York was already up to 108. February 15, New York is number 2 in the country now. They have 164 DSPs. They have grown 78% since July of 2014. We have grown 39%. We have gone from at one point being number 2 behind California in 2010 to being number 7. On the growth percentage, we're actually number 8 of the top 10. The reason why I bring this all out, because if you look at the New York example, they did a lot of what you guys want to do, which is great. You really want to make it easier. We really want to expand the industry. Tourism, we've all talked about that, bringing people here. What New York did was not only do that, but they put their money where their mouth was. And that was a big deal. And I kind of promised I wouldn't say this, but I'm going to anyway, because this is my last time. surcharges are bad news for all of us. Beer, wine, spirits, cider, they're bad news. They look at something that goes to the consumer, but in fact, that's not the case. You walk into a liquor store in December and you see Bullet on sale for $21 when they normally sell for $28. And you're thinking to yourself, they take a $7 cut for a month? Good God. So when you take a look at the big ones, they're going to look at the surcharge and go, well, we kind of want to maintain the current price we're at, so we're going to eat it. Look at me eating the surcharge. My product goes from $29.95 to $30.45. You just crossed into another bill out of your wallet. Now the consumer is going to look at my product differently. So then I'm kind of backed into it. Well, if I want to keep the price, I'm going to have to eat it, not the consumer. So I just warned against surcharges. It doesn't hit the consumer. It hits the producers as well, and especially the small producers. So things I've highlighted for you today, giving you a good definition of what a DSP is. So now if I ever talk about it more, you know that one. Support of the Vermouth Bill. We've talked to you about evolutionary and revolutionary and how it's going to be the revolutionary steps that are going to really take the distilled spirits market in this state back up to where it needs to be, which in my opinion is in the top 5, if not in the top 3. So thank you, and I'll answer any questions you might have.
That's great. Anybody have questions for these two gentlemen? Rep Helm.
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Give me an example of things that both of your associations do to bring sort of newer members up into the ranks of being productive and more experienced. Do you help them? Either or both.
Like new breweries, new guild members.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, what you know, we try to do as a guild is, you know, obviously, one of our missions is to represent the industry before the legislature and that sort of thing. But we also do some, and we're starting to do a little more of this, do some educational meetings throughout the year that may range from, you know, technical brewing matters to marketing issues and things like that. We have an annual meeting where we try to bring as much of the membership together as possible, and we have some educational components there. And so that's one way that we assist not just new members, but all members. You know, Brian, our retention, who's our executive director. He's always available to new members, and I think he spends a good chunk of his day answering emails and phone calls with questions that range from, you know, licensing issues to concerns that folks have with legislative matters, matters with local municipalities, things like that. And I know that I put my contact information out as a board member and president of the guild to guild members, that they're free to contact me anytime with questions or concerns that they have. Another big component of what the guild does is marketing Oregon beer, and we've gone through a rebranding, I guess, of the kind of marketing component of the guild in the last couple of years, with some new graphics and website, OregonBeer.org, and to market beer, not just internally in the state, but to drive up the tourism angle and beer exports to other states. We list events on the website, and one thing I've discovered in Oregon is that you can. I've given up trying to schedule a beer event on a day that there isn't another beer event happening. It's just not possible, so I don't even worry about that anymore. The website, we have kind of a clearinghouse for that. We also put out the Brewhaw Guide, which is a map and a description of every brewery in the state, which is a little pamphlet that we distribute free of charge to breweries and other beer-related businesses. And so every guild member gets a listing in there, and that has become a really handy, you know, tangible benefit for beer tourists to come to the state.
Great. And I'll go brief on it. Just marketing arm, we have the Oregon Distillery Trail that our members are all listed on. In addition to that, we've gone and obtained sponsorships from various vendors that actually pass on percent discounts to our members. So they actually get a direct financial benefit. We've expanded our board to include different zones now, so we have representation from all over the state on our board itself. We also have similar type of events where we get our membership together for the purpose of either educational or vendor involvement with that. And I would say it's very odd if I don't have a week go by where I'm not spending about an hour or two on the phone with the distillery that's, how in the H did you do this? And if I don't know the answer, I know someone that does. So there's a lot of that camaraderie that exists actually in all of our industries that are going to present to you today, which is the reason why I've had other distillers come in and take a look at our brewing techniques, because we were having some issues a while ago. It's that kind of camaraderie you will find in across the industry and even within the industry. So it's a lot of fun.
Excellent. Rhett Post.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a quick question on the New York statistics. Mm-hmm. I probably could have just Googled it real quick, but is New York State sort of like Oregon? Does it have an OLCC or is it private sale?
They are actually non-controlled, if I remember correctly. Yeah, they're non-controlled state. So they deal distributors and what have you.
Okay, so the follow-up.
Sure, please.
The follow-up then would be the examples of selling a cocktail at the distillery, as you were talking about. Can that work in Oregon? I guess is the winery. Maybe I can answer anybody.
I'll say the answer is yes.
Okay, because what I'm seeing is competition with Joe's Bar and Grill.
Yeah, I'll tell you why. When someone, we don't want to be Joe's Bar and Grill.
Right.
It's kind of funny, of our tasting room, I don't have chairs. Mm. I don't want you hanging out. I want you to have sample the product, buy a bottle, and eject, right? With the cocktail, I might be so inclined to put in a stool or two. But the idea behind it is you actually get to experience the cocktail or the spirit as it's intended and be able to have that full cocktail. We can do sample cocktails, so I don't want to make sure I give you as much information as I can, but I know I have a limited amount of time. We can do sample cocktails, and we can even charge for sample cocktails. But the idea of being able to do a full cocktail is something that will draw more people in which in that case will actually encourage them to do the purchases and what have you. It's that brew pub, that essentially, you know, type environment that we would be able to create, and we would design our tasting rooms differently.
Okay.
As a result of doing that, which means we would have to hire people, we'd have to hire contractors to do the work, and so forth and so on. It's also in the Constitution, the food requirement here. So, but I'm sure no one's ever amended the Constitution here, right? So, yeah. So it does require that.
Excellent.
Okay, thanks.
Okay. Rep. Marsh, thank you.
Just a quick question. Thank you, Madam Chair. This is a question for Dan. I understood you to say that one of the things that supported the development of the industry is a very favorable legal framework here in Oregon. We don't always have people coming up saying that we're doing something that's very favorable to the industry. So I wondered if you would just spend a minute and tell us what we're doing right.
Well, I think, you know, I often talk about this when I talk to brewers from other states, and they're often surprised to learn, you know, what you can do in Oregon with a, for example, a brew pub license, you know, that you know, for $262.50 a year, I can produce beer, I can retail that beer, I can self-distribute that beer at Brew Point, I can sell other breweries' beer in my retail location. I currently have two retail locations under that license. So there's a, I think Oregon has a very favorable climate in what we're allowed to do within our regulatory structure. There's often room for improvement here and there, but I think compared to a lot of states, we're in generally a pretty good position. For example, the ability and my brewery operates under a brew pub license, which is fairly common for small breweries. That ability to self-distribute initially is huge for startups. The first 8 months that we were in business, we were self-distributing, and the first day that we put beer in kegs, we sold a keg of beer to a tavern on the street, and that was revenue. And so in states that are much more locked into a traditional three-tier system that don't have that self-distribution component, that's difficult because you have to have a distribution agreement lined up from the get-go. So that's just one example of things that are favorable in Oregon, but I think that climate, and it's something that's obviously been evolving over the years, but is really contributes to the fact that we have so many breweries here. It's easier to get started, and I think that, you know, I mean, people like to beat up on the OLCC, but in my experience, they've been great to deal with. They're actually one of my preferred bureaucracies to deal with. I always, you know, I can call up, I get friendly response, get good answers from folks, and they're generally good to work with, and at least in my experience. So I think we have it pretty good here. I think we have a system that's conducive to startups getting off the ground, and keeping the industry going.
Thank you. Thank you both for your work on behalf of Oregon manufacturing and artisan trade work, and thanks for your information today. I hope that we'll be able to continue these conversations. You know, I think if this committee ends up being an ongoing home for work to support our beverage sector, I hope you'll encourage your colleagues and, you know, your successor, Mr. Pappas, to give us ideas for things that we can do better, because we're trying to be a supportive ally. So thanks a lot.
Thank you.
With that, I'm going to call forward Harry Peterson Nedry, past president of Oregon Wine Growers Association, and Dan Jarman with the Oregon Wine Growers Association to do a brief overview of the wine sector. And then as time is kind of moving steadily forward, we're going to move efficiently into hearings and work sessions on two bills, and then public hearings on two others. So welcome, gentlemen. If you could begin in either order, state your name for the record. We'd love to hear what you have to say.
Great. Good morning, Madam Chair. Dan Jarman, representing the Oregon Wine Growers Association. Today we're going to give you, as the Chair said, a brief sort of industry overview and then talk about just a couple of issues that we're working on this session. I'm very happy to have Harry Peterson-Nedry here today. He is really one of the leaders of our industry, one of those visionary leaders. When we see how the wine industry has grown over the years, it's because of people like Harry who've been involved in the policymaking and other things to promote the industry. So we're very fortunate to have him today here today. And also, I'm very happy to see a lot of the members of this committee have wine in your district. So I think a lot of this will touch pretty close to home. So let me turn it over to Harry, and then I'll wrap up after he's done.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan. Chair Leininger and members of the committee, I have been a member of the Oregon wine industry since 79, 80, when I began looking for vineyard land. The industry right now is 50 years old, plus we're in our 52nd year, so we have been around. I put that in context. I visited Europe about 3 weeks ago, and one of the opportunities was to tout what we've always done, which is to try to protect place names for wine-growing regions outside of Oregon. It's very important to us. I had the opportunity to be in Chianti Classico, which is a wine region, obviously, in Italy, and they were celebrating on this occasion where we were congratulating them on their place name and what significance it has worldwide. They were celebrating their 300th anniversary. So it puts things in a bit of comparison. Relative to them, we're 1/6 the age of them. But we've accomplished a lot over the years. I have been chair of the Oregon Wine Board, president of the Oregon Wine Growers Association, have been president of the Willamette Valley Wineries Association, and there are a lot of other organizations that you create over 50 years that you have to drive forward, and there is a nucleus of us who have been responsible either in doing that or in picking up pieces when somehow we needed to get things going. What we want to do is give you a short status of where we are as an industry. The reputation of the Oregon wine industry is great worldwide, or else, for example, I would not have been asked to be on the, a very small panel at this event.
And I'm going to jump in and note that we are extremely delighted to have you here, and it is a small panel, but I am realizing I have one additional person to call up, and that is Tiny Irwin of General Distributors Oregon Beer Wine. And thank you. So come on up, and please continue your presentation, sir.
Welcome.
And then at the end, we're going to go to Mr. Irwin after Mr. Jarman, but wanted to make sure you were all in the uncomfortable position of being in the spotlight. Apologize for that.
Well, we
you,
are
sir,
a family anyway.
That's right.
I mean, all of us talking today so far.
Great.
The Oregon wine industry now, as I think OLCC has mentioned, Oregon wine industry has seen great growth, both as far as vineyards, which of course touch all of the rural areas. We do not in general have wineries in places that we don't grow grapes, so we require rural areas for that. We have over 700, approximately 750 bona fide brick and mortar wineries and winery brands. We have over 1,000 grape growers in the state, and this represents basically a 500% increase over the last 15 years. So we began small, but have continued to increase almost exponentially. The Oregon wine industry has an impact that, again, I think the OLCC representatives mentioned is $3.3 or so billion dollars worth annually. We take an assessment of that through market research about every 2 or 3 years. The part that's key to that is, of course, wine tourism, just as the craft brew and distilled spirits industry show. People come here to basically put things down their very educated palates. We draw people for beer, for distilled spirits, and, of course, for wine. We are, at this point, concentrated in the I-5 corridor, but we are not exclusive to that, even though 70% or so of the grapes that are grown in Oregon are in the Willamette Valley. We have far-reaching industry impacts in places like Walla Walla in extreme northeastern Oregon, down in southern Oregon, in the Hood River Gorge area, even in central Oregon these days, a nascent industry is growing there. So we are concentrated in the Willamette Valley, and we're concentrated specifically with Pinot Noir as a grape variety that has given us the international recognition that we have. At the same time, just like we are not limited to the Willamette Valley and great things can happen in other places, we are not limited to Pinot Noir either. There are something like 72 other grape varieties that are grown, some of them in the same areas as Pinot Noir, others to accommodate the warmer or drier regions of the state that we talk about outside of the Willamette Valley. Despite what we think of the industry and how great we think it is, and that people pat us on the back, we are still only 1.5% of the wines that are made in the U.S. Approximately 90% of the wines made in the U.S. are from California, about 6% from Washington, etc. So we're relatively small as far as the amount of wine, but the impact of the wine and the quality of the wine is what differentiates us. We, just as an example, we have focused on quality as an industry. We have focused on making admittedly small amounts of wine, but making it as good as you can find worldwide. So we have standards that are hard to meet many times, but we still demand that rigor of ourselves. We demand high quality. As an example of that, even though we're 1.5% of what is consumed in the or grown and made in the U.S., if you take a look at just one metric, let's just say the Wine Spectator, which is a major wine consumer wine magazine, they rate wines. They give them 0 to 100 points, and great wines are 90 points and above, despite the fact that we only make up 1.5% of the wines in the U.S. We make greater than 20% of the wines that are 90 and above that are made in the U.S. So it gives a sense as to where we essentially hang our hat. We hang our hat on high quality. One of the other things that gives you a sense of the quality that we make is some of the recognition that gradually accrues, especially if you're over 50 years old. We this year received the award for the Wine Region of the Year worldwide from another of the major publications on wine. The Willamette Valley was the Wine Region of the Year for the wine enthusiast. Also, one of the reasons that I was in Europe 3 weeks ago, because I don't make every month or two a visit to Europe, was to present to the European Union a request that the Willamette Valley, as again, the signature wine growing region, though not the exclusive one for Oregon, that it be given official and formal recognition by the EU as a geographic indication, which basically means a formal wine growing region that they would protect and recognize, and that they would then support as if we were a wine region inside Europe. That is something that's yet to come, but that we expect within the next 6 to 9 months. So this is descriptive of the type of recognition worldwide that the Oregon wine industry has. Because of the recognition for quality, consumers are willing to pay more for Oregon wines than they might for other wines. This bar graph gives an example of average bottle price and then the growth of sales.
I'm going to ask make a request as we move forward. Unfortunately, we only have till 9:45 for our meeting, and so I think we really need to finish with this panel no later than 9:15 in order to be able to move through the committee bills that we have. So if you could, in the next maybe 3 minutes.
I will expedite
minutes,
it.
Yeah, and then Mr. Jarman and Mr. Irwin, if you could also try to squeeze it in between now and 9:45, that would be great. Thanks.
Okay. One of the things that Dan will talk to in just a second is the recognition of the fact that from a marketing perspective, even though from a quality perspective and wine recognition perspective, we have accomplished a great deal, there is always marketing to be done. And one of the impediments that we see is that the world has turned upside down, as this graphic may show, over the period of the last 20 or 30 years. And we now have a marketplace where instead of having as many distributors nationwide as we have wineries, we now have, as you can see here in 2015, we now have 8,800 wineries in the U.S., and they have to go through the funnel of 700 distributors to find people who will want to buy their wines. They are extremely they are extremely picky and continue to eat each other and condense themselves. Fewer distributors mean less opportunity for wineries, and that is one of the constraints that we see that need to be addressed over the next few years.
Great.
I'll turn it over.
Just, Madam Chair, just very briefly, and to that point, the one thing we'll jump to, the legislative initiative that's most important in the wine industry this year is Senate Bill 316, which would create, under the wine board, sort of a new program for market access. This is the, you know, we have quality wines. We have a lot more wines than we've had in the past, but having problems, especially for our smaller wineries, those markets to sell the wines. And so this would create a new program within the wine board to be able to look at new market access opportunities as well as direct some money to specific research. The bill's down in Ways and Means. Hopefully you'll hear about this at some point, be able to see it on the floor. Very happy to answer any questions that you have. And thank you for having us today.
Thank you so much. That's great, and your sector is extremely important. I appreciate this wonderful PowerPoint that you've included, and we look forward to talking more about Senate Bill 316. Mr. Irwin.
Good morning, Madam Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Steve Tiny Irwin. I'm the Chief Operating Officer for General Distributors Incorporated. I'm here today in my capacity as Vice President of the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association, where we represent 17 Oregon beer and wine distributors. By way of background, General Distributors was founded back in 1921 by Charles Fick Sr. We're a third-generation family-owned distributor here in the state of Oregon. We started off as a fixed cigar company during Prohibition, where we sold candy cigarettes and cigars. Right after Prohibition was repealed, we were the first Olympia distributor in the state of Oregon. Lots of history. We now currently, we started off with three trucks and three delivery people, and you fast forward 96 years and we now have a fleet of about 35 trucks and 170 employees. I'm here today to talk to you about Oregon's independent beer and wine distributors and the value they bring to the state and our communities. As a beer and wine distributor, we're licensed by both the federal and state government, and we deliver bottles, cans, kegs, and cases from brewers, wine growers, and importers to the shelf for your favorite retail establishments, on tap at your favorite bars and restaurants. We work closely with new brands to help them to get to market and ensure that consumers can choose from a vast selection of beer and wine. As an independent beer and wine distributor, we are local businesses that provide thousands of family wage jobs and excellent benefits to the people who live in our communities. We've provided the committee with a breakdown of the billions of dollars in economic benefits Oregon receives from the beer, wine, and distilled spirits industry and our numerous partners. One of my proud facts that I can tell you is that in the last year, I've added 70 new full-time family wage employees to our company, which is a 21.4% increase, which is really, really exciting to see in our community. As a distributor, we do more than buy, store, sell, deliver beer and wine. We're small business owners. We're civic leaders, we're parents, and we're philanthropists who are active in our communities. We play a vital role in working to keep the communities where we live and work safe by sponsoring a wide array of programs to promote responsible consumption, combat drunk driving, and work to eliminate underage drinking. We also value the role in the state-based system of alcohol regulation that works to keep communities and citizens safe while encouraging healthy competition in the robust marketplace. I want to talk to you just briefly about the three-tier system. Oregon's independent beer and wine distributors are a critical link in the three-tier distribution system. That three-tier system is made up of suppliers, which are brewers, winemakers, distillers, distributors, and retailers. This three-tier system provides the infrastructure, capital, and personnel that small brewers and wine growers need to reach a wide network of retailers. Distributors infrastructure includes state-of-the-art warehouses, fleets of temperature-controlled vehicles, trucks that preserve these perishable products. Distributors personnel include not only the handling of the warehouse handling but the storage, but the delivery and merchandising and sales of these products. We as a distributor deliver customized inventory based on the requirements of each individual retailer in their local market.
So I am going to just note that you've got about 2 minutes before we're going to need to transition to the bills, but this is a helpful part of the infrastructure of this important sector. So
this is really, and that's really what it's about. I want you all to understand what we as distributors do. It's not that we don't just store beer and wine, but we provide hundreds of jobs within our community, and that's who we are. And that's what we do.
Great, thank you. Anybody have a pretty succinct question for the great people of this panel? Rep. Marsh.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just quickly, I wondered if you wanted to comment on the issue that was raised by your comrades up there in terms of the declining number of distributors available.
Well, that may be wine wholesalers. Beer wholesalers are growing. There's been three new small distributors that have opened up within the last couple of years. Just that are beer only, that we've actually, as a company, as GDI, we've helped them get up and running because we know there's a need for more distributors out there.
In Oregon,
yeah.
Oh. Okay.
Great. All right. Well, thank you so much for your work, and we look forward to seeing the bill that you referenced, and I look forward to reviewing your PowerPoint more carefully. Mr. Peterson, Nedry, that's great. Thank you all
thank
very
you.
Much.
Thank you.
And with that, we're going to close the informational hearing on the beverage sector industry, and we're going to open a public hearing and work session. Can I do all this? On House Bill 2089, which has to do with sale of vermouth. And we're going to invite forward Mr. Jesse Sweet to give us some brief background after we hear from Adam Crawford.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2089 allows liquor stores and distillery retail outlets agents to sell vermouth for off-premises consumption. Specifies vermouth sold must be in factory sealed containers.
Go ahead, Mr. Sweet.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jesse Sweet with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. My agency takes no position on this bill. I was asked to come forward and provide a little bit more background. OLCC retail liquor agents are able to sell vermouth and other related items as a convenience to customers. We currently carry 10 vermouths in our warehouse for distribution to these agents. There are two types of retail liquor agents. An exclusive liquor agent sells only spirits and related items. A non-exclusive liquor agent can carry just about anything. So in the Portland metro area or in Salem, that might look like a liquor agent who stocks a lot of beer and wine under an off-premise license. Out in rural Oregon, that might look like a liquor store that's co-located with a bait and tackle shop. The reason this distinction is important is because it matters in terms of distribution of vermouths. Those exclusive agents are limited to those 10 vermouths which we stock in the warehouse. The non-exclusive license, a non-exclusive agent who holds an off-premise license can get a full range of vermouths from any Oregon distributor. What this bill proposes is it allows any agent, regardless of their designation, to stock up to 20 SKUs of vermouth, which they would acquire from a wholesaler, and it's for sale to a customer rather than to bars and restaurants. So it would be the same lack of credit terms, that anyone else buys, any other buyer from a wholesaler would enjoy, these people are going to enjoy. The goal here is to allow greater flexibility in offering a range of products to consumers, including craft specialty products and rare imported items. I've been speaking about the liquor agents. You also heard Mr. Pappas speak to distillery agents. Distillery agents who have approval to taste in their tasting rooms are often mixing vermouths with their products in order to feature them for the customer. What this bill allows is it allows that distillery agent to sell a bottle of vermouth that a customer has sampled. With that, I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Great, thanks. So if we don't have questions, it's a pretty straightforward bill to address a tangible problem and hopefully make things easier for businesses. If we don't have any questions, I'll ask for a motion.
Sure, welcome to work the bill. I move that House Bill 2089 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
All right, Vice Chair Brocksmith moves House Bill 2089 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Any objections? All right, seeing none, the bill moves forward. The motion is passes. And Representative Gomberg, would you be open to carrying this bill?
Happy to help.
All right,
thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Sweet. We'll close the hearing and work session on House Bill 2089, and we will open public hearing and work session on House Bill 2159 and invite Mr. Jesse Sweet to say a few words after Adam Crawford does make initial comments.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2159 changes the definition of cider by increasing the allowable alcohol by volume limit from 7% to 8.5%, exempts licensee producing only cider from specified licensee, winery licensee requirements. This bill has a minimal fiscal impact and a revenue light.
All right. Could you please give us a quick walkthrough again? Thanks.
For the record, I remain Jesse Sweet with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I think Mr. Crawford's given an excellent summary there. This is really just to align with federal definitions so that our cider producers in Oregon only have to follow one set of rules when they're making their tax filings to the federal government and to the state of Oregon.
That's great. So any questions about that? All right, then We're in a work session. Okay, we'll open a work session on House Bill 2159, and I'll ask for a motion.
Chair Leininger, I move House Bill 2159 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference.
Vice Chair Brocksmith moves House Bill 2159 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the House Committee on Revenue by prior reference. Is there any discussion? Any objections? Seeing none, the motion carries. So it just goes straight to that. Okay, great. And I want to note that this work, which we've just supported through House Bill 2159, I think aligns with some work that Congressman Blumenauer has done at a federal level in order to streamline the regulatory burden applicable to cider makers at a federal level. So hopefully we can get this through House Revenue and onto the floor so that we can move forward and support these businesses. All right, with that, we will open a public hearing on House Bill 2150 and invite Mr. Crawford to describe that bill.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2150 requires the Oregon Liquor Control Commission to allow manufacturers or distributors of wine, ciders, or malt beverages to electronically file both a statement of quantity of wine, cider, or malt beverage produced, purchased, or received, and pay privilege taxes starting on such activity starting January 1st, 2018, becomes effective on the 91st day after sine die.
Excellent. I would like to release Mr. Sweet from being trapped up there at the speaker's dais and invite Brian Butenshin, the Oregon Brewers Guild, and Bill Schutte from OLCC to come forward. Thanks, Brian, for being here today and for bringing your colleague to talk about Brewers Guild matters also. Mr. Schutte, would you like to begin with kind of a statement of the problem this bill seeks to solve? Again, we're not moving this bill today, but we're having a hearing so that we can do any further refinements that are needed.
For the record, Chair, committee members, Bill Schutte, economist with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. The beer and wine tax collection system is a bit antiquated in the state of Oregon. It is a complete paper system. Breweries, wineries, distributors, manufacturers throughout the state, wine and beer, have to file monthly. They have to pay monthly. It's all in statute. It's a totally paper system. The matching is manual. This bill would help us automate that system and make it less manual and also allow the taxpayers to pay electronically online as well.
Excellent. Mr. Butenshin, welcome.
Thank you, Chair Leininger and members of the committee. My name is Brian Butenshin. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Brewers Guild. And we made some recommendations to Chair Leininger's. She has an interest in seeing, like, what are some of the similarities and differences between beer producers on a state and a federal level. And at the federal level, we've seen reduction in what we've seen first is electronic reporting and then reduction in the frequency of reporting and frequency of payments and then removal of bonds for small producers. And so we suggested that this might be a good avenue for considering the number of wineries, number of breweries, the kind of expansion that we've seen, the reduction of paperwork, I think would make sense on a state level as well. And so we suggested that this is something that they should look at.
Thank you. That was a great suggestion, and hopefully this will be something that we can do that's productive. As I understand it right now, we're not going to work the bill today because we don't have all the completed paperwork on the fiscal, and the agency, the OLCC, is talking to LFO or LRO to make sure that we can get that through. But in the meantime, does anyone have any questions for this good team? All right. I really appreciate your teamwork in helping us identify an opportunity to support streamlining for the sector. And with that, thanks for being here. We'll close the public hearing on House Bill 2150 and hopefully invite you back soon to watch this bill sail through our committee. And the final bill that we are going to be looking at today is House Bill 2160. So we'll open a public hearing on that bill. Again, we're not moving it today because we have some amendments to consider and or perhaps in development. And with that, should we ask Mr. Sweet for it again one last time for old time's sake? And Adam Crawford, if you could please describe the bill. And then we'll invite a team of other folks who will be able to speak to us about possible amendments.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2160 allows a brewery public house licensee to also hold an off-premises sales license.
Mr. Sweet, can you describe the problem that this bill is intended to solve? And then we'll invite forward Paul Romaine, Dan Engler, and Brian Butenshin to talk about the bill and any adjustments that need to be made.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Jesse Sweet with the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. This bill is intended to allow flexibility for brew pub licenses that expand beyond two locations. The way that the brew pub statute is written is there is a host of retail privileges at the brewery public house's first location and at their second location. If a brew pub chain wants to move on to additional locations, they need to cobble together different license types. So this was designed to make that easier for them, specifically to allow the combination of licenses to offer six packs and other beverages to go. You are going to hear from some stakeholders that they have issues with the bill as it's currently drafted. I've spoken with them, and I'm very confident that we can do some simple amendments to this bill that will accomplish the goal I've just described and address all of the issues that the stakeholders may have.
Well, fantastic. Then without further delay, let us please invite forward Paul Romaine, Dan Engler, and Brian Butenshin. Thank you.
Go first.
Hi there.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, I'm Paul Romaine. I'm an attorney in Portland with the Romaine Group, and we represent the Oregon Beer and Wine Distributors Association. In reviewing House Bill 2160, we understood what was attempted to be done. The problem with the addition of the old license is it expands it sort of beyond what the folks who are interested in that problem really wanted to do. So we feel we can sit down and just within an hour come up with a solution to the issue of how do you get a brew pub the ability to sell for off-premise, maybe under their own license. They don't have to get a second license to do the same thing. So just streamlining the process. The way it's set up with just getting an O license, it expands it for potential abuse. We don't know whether it would occur or not, although sometimes things you don't anticipate do occur. So we just like a little more time to do it. The brew pub license is a very interesting license. It actually came into being in 1985, and you heard some earlier testimony that I was sitting back kind of jumping at the chance to maybe come up and tell you a little bit about it, because I'm the person who's been around here since time began and actually was part of that whole process. And what happened at that point is you could be in certain segments of the industry but not combine segments of the industry. You could be in the manufacturing end as a brewery. You could be in the retail end as a restaurant, but you couldn't combine the two. So what the brew pub license did, as opposed to the brewery license, is it allowed you to be in two segments, both manufacturing and retailing, or get the brewery license itself, which allowed you to be in manufacturing and wholesaling. But you had to pick two of the three. And we all took a chance at that point because traditionally throughout history, since the end of Prohibition, there's been this restriction on what you could do. We took a chance in Oregon, and you can see what it led to. And that's why most people involved in the business will tell you that it's our legal structure in Oregon is so much more progressive than any other state. It's allowed for all these different things to occur. And every once in a while, there's a little thing we have to change because, again, it's alcohol and you have all these different things out there that you have to deal with. But doing these small incremental changes are very important. It's important to make sure they're not too broad because then you end up with some unintended consequences. The other thing is, what we did over the years is we allowed everybody to self-distribute. So whereas you heard testimony about the diminishing number of distributors out there, and frankly that's because the margins on product are slimmer and slimmer as time goes on, what we do, so in a lot of states you find that producers cannot get to market without going through a distributor. We do not allow that in Oregon. We allow people who produce product to get their own product to market, the wine growers, the breweries, and the brew pubs. And it has worked extremely well for us. Finally, what I want to do is compliment the chair for having this hearing. I've been around this legislative process for a long time. I think before some of you were even born. This is the first time since I've been around this process that we've had an overview of the industry like this, where everybody could come in and talk about it. And we thank you for doing that. This has been a very, very good thing to do. It's important, I believe, to do it every few years so people understand what the industry does. We all are competitors in the industry, but we're all partners also. So this is a very good opportunity for us to present to you. And again, thank you very much for doing it.
Well, thank you for your help as we try to identify places where the legislature can support improved opportunity in the sector. And I'm hopeful that you can get an amendment crafted that will enable us to pass a bill that is helpful, that meets that delicate balance. Thanks, gentlemen, and we look forward to hearing from you. In whatever order.
Okay, Chair Leininger, members of the committee, we believe that we can. My name is Brian Butenchin. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Brewers Guild. Thank you. We believe that that what we can do is construct a fix to this bill that would allow, that would bring the privilege of selling packaged beer, whether it's from the brew pub manufacturer, other manufacturers, to go to bring it into the license. And I think the intention was to have the ability for each brew pub licensee at that location to allow that privilege and not necessarily allow them to have additional outlets that would sell packaged beer to go. And I think if we can construct a fix that addresses those issues, that we would be supportive of that.
Great. Thanks.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, Dan Engler, again, president of the Oregon Brewers Guild. I actually don't think I have a lot to add to that. I think it's just been a lot, other than it's previously been understood, I think, by a number of outlets that this was sort of the intention of the existing language in the brewpub bill. So I think it's really just in need of some clarification, as Mr. Romaine suggested, rather than necessarily adding the privilege of a separate license. So,
great. Thank you. Any questions for this panel? All right. Well, then you're free to go back to your seats or out into the world. But before we adjourn the meeting, I just want to note that with great thanks to the co-chairs of the Committee on Small Business Growth, we had a chance to do some closer looking into the essentially adult beverage sector over the last interim and into now. And it's an amazing opportunity for us to grow tourism opportunities, for us to create support the growth of small businesses and and support the growth of already established businesses. It's a field in which Oregon already has demonstrated world-class potential and performance. So by helping us expand these manufacturing opportunities and increase our market share in the traded sector, we can check a lot of the boxes for what people in the economic development sector describe as best practice. This is just one initial set of steps into the arena, but hopefully you, with your guidance, will identify additional ways to support your work, and we look forward to seeing those graphs and tables when you have taken over the world market in the adult beverage sector. And with that, we'll adjourn the meeting for today. Oh, please, Rep. Gomberg.
Well, go ahead. As the gavel was almost down, Madam Co-Chair, I just wanted to say twice today you have recognized the co-chairs of the Interim Small Business Growth Committee, and I just wanted to stress that that was really a team effort and a staff effort, and everybody in the committee process made these bills possible, including, of course, yourself. So I just wanted to get that on the record as well.
Well, sure was a good reason to hold the gavel for that. Thank you, sir. With that, thanks, everyone. We're adjourned. that, thanks everybody.